Welcome to today's program titled, So You Want an Injunction in a Non-Compete or Trade Secret Case? At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only, and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Justin Beyer. You may begin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Seyfarth Shaw's seventh installment of its trade secret webinar series for 2015. Joining me today is Eric Barton, counsel in our Atlanta office who focuses on complex commercial litigation with a focus on trade secret non-compete law, and Bob Stevens, an L&E partner also in our Atlanta office who is an L&E attorney by trade but also focuses on trade secret non-compete litigation. I am located in our Chicago office with a primary focus on trade secret and non-compete law. Today, we are going to be covering a variety of topics. We're going to start the webinar off by giving an overview of what a trade secret is and what precisely goes into defining that for a court. We're also going to spend some time talking about non-compete agreements, their level of enforceability, and a very, very high-level overview of which states you should pay particular attention to if your employee resides there. We're then going to start to spend some time talking about considerations an employer must take in deciding whether to bring a lawsuit and some of the best practices that go into protecting assets both before and after termination or resignation of an employee who you believe threatens your customer relationships or trade secrets. And finally, making the assumption that you have decided to move into litigation, we're going to talk a bit about the types of non-compete trade secret litigations and some of the expectations that you, the client, should have for both the litigation process itself and how that's going to impact your business. At this point in time, I'm going to turn over the presentation to Eric Barton, who's going to start talking about those first several topics.
Great. Thank you, Justin. And good afternoon or good morning, I guess, depending on where y'all are to everyone. Before we get into the details and sort of nitty-gritty of how to actually go about getting an injunction in a trade secret or non-compete case, the first step really is determining whether you even have a legitimate trade secret or enforceable non-compete agreement. And obviously, if you can't establish that you have an enforceable trade secret or non-compete agreement, you're not going to get very far with the next step, which is seeking and obtaining an injunction based on that. So I'm going to sort of lay the foundation really for Bob and Justin with a bit of a discussion on, you know, what is a trade secret and then what is a non-compete agreement, and really focus on the elements that should be considered, which you need to meet in order to go to the next step, which is proceeding with the case. So do you have a trade secret to protect? Generally, a trade secret is defined using these four prongs, if you will, these four elements: information generally not known to others that's economically valuable, and reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy exist. oftentimes sort of point two and point four, the generally not known to others, the secret part of the trade secret, and the reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy are typically the most fought after. Information is less so, but there can be fights about whether it's economically valuable or not. But two and four is typically where the fights really are. So we'll talk about specifically in regards to the reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. We'll talk about that in a bit. I've given here some examples of what trade secrets can be, everything from chemical processes and formulas. Customer lists often come up. We see that a lot, fighting over that, marketing plans, et cetera. It obviously covers a wide variety of things. Put some bullet points up here about what a trade secret is. As I say, it doesn't have to be novel or unique. No registration need be filed. There's no requirement that you file, quote unquote, file a trade secret anywhere. It's not a registrar of trade secrets. It is not published, and that's pretty key. It goes to sort of not generally known to the public. A trade secret that becomes known to the public is no longer a trade secret. Two or more can independently possess the same secret. Keyword there is independently. If someone independently developed a trade secret and someone else independently developed the same process or formula, they would both have trade secrets as long as they independently did it and one didn't develop it by using information that was made public by the other. And it may be made up of things that are not themselves trade secrets. Trade secrets can be common parts that are put together in a unique way that someone else hadn't put those common elements together in that way before. Next is a slide that sets forth six factors to determine whether information constitutes a trade secret or not. And I'll start off by saying, you know, obviously trade secrets aren't typically stamped trade secrets. I mean, they don't get, you know, a top secret logo put on them or anything like that. And as a result, there's often fights over whether something is a trade secret or not, because there's not really a bright line test. That said, there are many states and more on the way that are enacting trade secret legislation. And in some of those states that have enacted legislation, they have clearly defined certain things, certain categories that can constitute information that is sort of de facto a trade secret. Even states that don't have statutory law addressing trade secrets, they may have fairly well-established common law addressing trade secrets that can provide some pretty good guidance as to whether the trade secret or the thing that you and your client are considering whether it is a trade secret or not may have been addressed by the court. So really, you know, there are these factors that are often used. They're all typically considered. There's not one that's dispositive. But really, the starting point in a trade secret analysis really is to drill down on the applicable law, whatever state that may be or states that may be, and look first and foremost to see, you know, is there a statute that addresses trade secrets, and really then go from there, because that really will be the starting point. Of these factors, I'd sort of highlight the sort of big ones, in my opinion, that are at least that we typically see getting fought over is sort of number one, the extent known outside the company, three, measures taken by the company to protect secrecy, and number six, all of these, particularly in cases involving trade secrets that may or may not have been disclosed via social media, come up quite a bit. As the sort of name trade secret suggests, trade secrets must not be generally known. And the heart of the issue, heart of the value, is to keep the information secret. And someone who is taking the position that information is indeed a protectable trade secret absolutely needs to show, really above anything else, that the information is not available to the public and those who can obtain economic value from disclosure or use. It needs to be protected from other people. And part and parcel with that is reasonable efforts, is the phrase that's often used, must be established to show that the trade secret or the purported trade secret issue is kept secret. And you need to be prepared to articulate the actual, which I've underlined, actual efforts to maintain secrecy. And again, there isn't a silver bullet on this. You know, these cases by their nature are typically very factual intensive about whether something's a trade secret or not, and whether reasonable efforts were taken or not. And this analysis about what reasonable efforts were taken is sort of inherently one of those factually intensive analyses. I've listed here some examples of things that you can point to, or ideally someone trying to establish a trade secret has in their favor. Everything from confidentiality agreements, which really is the best. If you had to pick one thing that's maybe the best, would be, you know, confidentiality agreements that spell out and address trade secrets specifically, and the more specific, the better. We then get into information security, everything from password protection to electronic data policies. You know, concrete written plans that limit access. And then examples of the company ideally can show, if, you know, things to the extent that there have been any breaches before, what it does to make sure the information is kept secret. I say here, you know, absolute secrecy is not required, which is true. I mean, courts recognize that, you know, trade secrets, and part of their definition is that they have value, right? So they're being used by a company. And by being used, obviously someone or some multiple people are relying on those trade secrets. So it's not like a trade secret just has to be locked into a vault and never exposed to anyone, because quite frankly, if that were the case, it may not have economic value. Someone's got to be using the trade secrets. So courts recognize that absolute secrecy is not required, and it also realizes that you do not have to do everything in that could possibly, in theory, be enacted to protect a trade secret. There, like I said, there's not a bright line rule on, you know, unless you do blank, you do not have a trade secret, which, then, like I said, goes back to the inherent sort of factual dispute that goes into, or factual analysis that goes into trade secrets or not. It's what's reasonable. But recognizing that companies with trade secrets have to be aware of what is reasonable, and oftentimes that does somewhat involve analyzing the marketplace of others who may have similar trade secrets and steps they take to protect those types of secrets. Next, I would hit on non-compete agreements. Put here sort of a basic definition of a non-compete agreement. A non-compete agreement is a provision in which one party, usually an employee, agrees not to enter into or start a similar profession or trade in competition against another party, you know, usually an employer. And a non-compete can be standalone. It can be an agreement that's just a, you know, entitled a non-compete agreement. It's its own document, and other times it's incorporated into larger agreements. Either is fine. There's no requirement really that I'm aware of in any state that says a non-compete agreement to be enforceable must be its own document. Though, and I note here at the end, and the last bullet point is very key, it must be narrowly tailored to protect a legitimate business interest. And that is oftentimes in dealing with non-compete cases where a lot is fertile ground for fights, is whether or not this non-compete agreement is indeed protecting a legitimate business interest. There is a wide variety of statutes and case law across the country that address non-compete agreements. And that, like much like the analysis of a trade secret, whether or not you have a valid trade secret, it's very similar that that's the starting point for non-compete cases. Go to the state that's at issue and first and foremost look, have they enacted any legislation governing non-compete agreements? As I note here, many states have. It's about 50-50 at this point. 28 have yet to do so. But, you know, if you're in California or North Dakota, for instance, they have prohibited non-compete agreements. So there's not much analysis to do beyond that point. Start with the statute. See if it's even permitted. From there, see what the statute says about it. And if you don't have statutes, really you're going to have to go straight to case law for guidance. Sort of further complicating matters is many states have enacted blue pencil or equitable reformation doctrines, or enact them and allow them. And what these do is they, as I explain here, they allow a court, it gives courts the ability to take an agreement that is otherwise invalid or parts of an agreement that are invalid and either strike them or rewrite them to make them valid under that particular state's law. Now, some states do not allow this. You know, the benefit as a lawyer when a state doesn't allow this, and you know, Georgia, for instance, several years ago did not allow blue penciling, and a couple years ago changed that. Under the old law, we could review a non-compete agreement, and if we saw certain things that were invalid, we could advise the client that that agreement was per se invalid and couldn't be used. Now, we note that certain portions may be unlawful, and then we get into a bit of a gray area about what exactly that means. What can the court do, and what would that leave? And so, good news, bad news. I mean, depending on what you want it to be, it can create a little bit more uncertainty. But that's something you need to be aware of when deciding whether to pursue the enforcement of a non-compete agreement. So a few takeaways. One size does not fit all when it comes to non-compete agreements. That said, do consider whether you use, when you have, particularly for those of you who have employees over multiple states, using a non-compete agreement that has a choice of law and venue provision, which in effect, if enforceable, would bring everything to another state. And really then you would have to just closely monitor that one state and make sure you're always complying with that one state rather than constantly or having multiple agreements under multiple states. Even if you do that, you got to be proactive and constantly monitor and pay attention to any changes in the state's law. Last but not least, I just want to put in a plug to that point. SIFARTH has put together a very good 50-state desktop reference that covers both non-compete agreements and trade secret agreements, trade secret law, state by state, with sort of columns explaining, you know, do they allow blue penciling, do they not, is there a trade secret legislation, is there not, and we're happy to provide that to anyone if you want to reach out to us. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Bob Stevens.
Thank you very much, Eric. I appreciate that. And so now I'm going to talk about briefly, so what do you do if you suspect you have a breach of a non-compete or a restrictive covenant agreement, or you have a suspected theft of a trade secret that Eric previously described? So you have a protectable business interest that you think may be stolen or is in jeopardy, such as customer relationships. So the whole non-compete agreement and the injunction, the whole presentation we're doing now is talking about whether or not you want to get an injunction. And the question is, when should an employer consider seeking a TRO or a preliminary injunction? And there are several situations which are on the screen now. First, talk about if somebody who's subject to a non-compete or a non-solicit, could also be a non-recruit of employees, announces he or she is resigning. Or an employee subject to those agreements is terminated. Or they leave and they announce that they're going to a competitor, or they open a competing business. Or you see at the bottom of your screen now, someone has left who is not subject to a restrictive covenant agreement, but is going to work for a competitor, and may be in a position to either threaten to use your trade secrets or is going to move into a job where they would inevitably use your trade secrets. For example, they were the CEO of your company and they go to work as the CEO of a competitor. Or they were a chemist or an engineer, or they drafted code for software and they're going to work for a direct competitor doing the exact same thing. So in their new role, even if they're not subject to a restrictive covenant agreement, there is no way they could do their job without disclosing and or using your trade secrets. The doctrine of inevitable disclosure may be applicable, and you may be able to file a lawsuit seeking a TRO or preliminary injunction based on that doctrine. So we have somebody who's leaving, who's going to work for a competitor, and has some sort of an agreement, or we think that they may have be in a position to use or threaten to use our trade secrets with a competitor. So what do we want to do, or what should we do prior to actually going into court and seeking what is emergency relief in the form of a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction? And the first thing you want to do is try to gather facts, as many facts as you can. You heard Eric mention that these cases are very fact-intensive, and that is true. And they're also very state-specific because the law varies dramatically from state to state. So we need to identify as many facts as we can on the front end to decide whether or not we, in fact, want to go into court. And understand, going into court is a very expensive proposition and can be very time-consuming, both on your legal department, if you have one, but also on the business. So what you first want to do is, if at all possible, talk to the employee who's leaving. See if they'll talk with you and have an exit interview. Before you do that, if possible, you'd like to go on to their computer activity and work activity and see if, in fact, they have been, for example, sending emails to their home, if they've been logging into the system at unusual times, have they been printing things off that they should not be printing. You want to identify this stuff on the front end, if possible, so when you meet with them, you can ask them about this activity. You also would like to go into their personnel file and find out what kind of agreements do they actually have. With large workforces, sometimes it's hard to fully understand what agreements people have. We often think our employees have non-compete agreements, and then we look in the personnel file, and for whatever reason, the agreement has not made its way to the file. And so therefore, we may be hamstrung in our ability to run into court. So we want to find out what kind of agreements do they have. Is there a non-solicit of employees, of customers? Is there a non-compete? Is there a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement that they have to live up to? And if we don't have that, have those kinds of agreements that we can find, have they been through some sort of training? Or is there a handbook that says, our information must remain confidential? You cannot disclose it, cannot give it to a competitor. There may be other ways other than a formal restrictive covenant agreement that could be a hook to go into court and get the protection you need to protect your customer relationships and your trade secrets. You also want to ensure, when you meet with the employee, if they'll meet with you, that you get all of your property back, your phones, your computers, any access cards, computers, tablets, things like that, that may have your information on it. You also want to make arrangements, if they have their own personal phone or personal computer that they have used for work, you want to work with them to get all of your information off of those devices, if at all possible. One way to do it would be to have your IT department take their computer and have it removed, possibly engaging a third-party neutral or forensic person to have it removed. Another option, obviously, is to just trust the employee, although there's some risk there if they've sent information to their home. So here I talked a little bit about kind of the questions you might want to ask an employee when they're leaving. Where are they going? Are they going to a competitor? What were their role? What would their job be at this new competitor? Are they a sales employee working for you, and they're going to be a sales employee selling the same products working for the competitor in the same geographic location? What kind of information did they have access to at your job? Did they have access to pricing information, to computer code, to customer lists? What kind of information do they have access to that they could take with them? So if they'll meet with you, you want to find this stuff out. And during this meeting, you would want to inform them of their continuing obligations under each of their respective agreements that they have with you, non-compete, non-solicit. And you might want to consider sending a letter to the employee, even if you haven't, there's no threat yet. You don't think that they're violating their agreements. You don't know if they've stolen anything, but a reminder letter, kind of reminding them of their obligations in written form, as well as sending the new employer a copy of that, a CC copy to the CEO or the legal department of the new employer, so they're definitely on notice of this agreement and of these obligations. So in the event you do run into court, if they violated it and the new employer knows about it, then they're likewise possibly in violation of a law or tortiously interfering with the contract you have with this employee. The one time I might caution against sending letters is if there's a concern that the non-compete might be brought in the lawsuit in one state where it would be found to be unenforceable through a declaratory judgment action. But if you were to file it in another state where it would be enforceable because of the way the laws vary, you might want to go in and seek an injunction before you alert them to it and give your former employee an opportunity to engage in forum shopping and possibly get the agreement held invalid. So that would be the one time you might not want to send a kind of a reminder letter. You might want to go ahead and run into court. Again, there are a lot of factors to think about in that process. Okay, so somebody has left, CEO, a C-suite person, a president, a salesperson. Even if you don't expect that there's foul play, right now they've left. Maybe they haven't, you don't even know where they're going because they won't talk with you. They've just resigned. If at all possible, you would want to maintain certainly their personnel file, but also any of their computers. Oftentimes computers, obviously they're assets and they're going to be repurposed and sent back out and used by another employee. But if you have the ability to image, do a forensic image or save the hard drive in case you need it, that would be very helpful in such a case, because if it gets repurposed and it's not saved, and then you have to end up in a lawsuit, you've lost a lot of potential evidence. Same thing with emails, to the extent you can save their emails going back 3 to 6 months for a period of time after they depart, before you're comfortable that they're not violating an agreement or using trade secrets, that would be very, very helpful in a potential lawsuit down the road. The second bullet you see on the page there is to terminate their access. I think it's very, very important that you terminate employees' access to the systems and to the office no later than the last day of employment. And if an employee is going to work out a notice period, you should be very, very careful about what kind of access they still maintain after they've informed you they're leaving, particularly if they're going to work for a competitor. Allowing an employee access to systems after they've informed you they're going to work for a competitor puts them into a position to get information and share it with a competitor. So I would recommend that certainly on their last day, the access be terminated, but it also should be done as soon as possible that you've learned that they are actually, in fact, leaving to go to work for a competitor. Okay, so you've identified the fact that someone's leaving and they're going to work for a competitor, and it's possible that they're going to breach their non-compete. They're going to be in a similar role doing the same job for a competitor in a similar geographic location, and or they're going to be in a position to use your trade secrets in a competitive way. You want to identify as many facts as you can to determine whether or not you should, in fact, run into court and seek emergency relief from a judge. And kind of what I have on the screen here is multiple ways that you can gather facts. And the fact gathering is excruciatingly important in seeking this kind of emergency relief. One way to do it would be to interview the employee's coworkers. People have a tendency to gossip, particularly in the sales capacity. Salesmen, they're very good at their jobs, but they're also very good at talking, which is why they're good at their job. So they often will tell coworkers what they're doing or you can see them kind of out in the marketplace. Like you may see, you see bullet point five down below. You may have seen a salesperson who was signed in on the sign-in sheet at a customer. So you can figure out kind of what they're doing. If you still have access to their computer that they were using, you can do a forensic image of that and look to determine, hey, did they, what's the USB usage? Have they plugged any thumb drives into this computer? What was their email access? You can go and look at their email. You can also run search terms, perhaps the competitor's name, through the computer to see if, in fact, anything shows up, such as emails with the competitor. And if you have the ability to look at their personal email account, and you might, depending upon what the computer shows, you can see if they were forwarding emails with trade secret information to their personal email account. And obviously, if they have a work phone, you can also look at the phone as well. And any text records there to see if they've been communicating with competitors prior to their departure. So I have kind of up on the screen now, many of you have probably experienced these kinds of cases. And it used to be, when I started practicing law, it was primarily documents that would disappear. You see kind of the cartoon on the top where the guy's taking information home. And I've certainly had cases where people took bags. I actually had a case where a woman, she carried a small purse, but the last 2 weeks of her employment, she started carrying a very large purse, and then ended up that she was taking hard copy files over to the competitor. She was copying them and then returning them. But nowadays, that's a rarity. You see on there the jump drive, and external storage devices are by far the number one way for transferring data. They will grab information, transfer it over to a thumb drive, drop it in their pocket, and leave. I've also seen more of the Dropbox usage, Google Drive, where people upload things to a Dropbox that's not secure, then they can just take it down at their home or at the competitor. Then, of course, emails. If you allow your employees to use their personal email accounts, it's fraught with risk to do that, but if they've done it, they have the ability to send attachments to their personal email account. So these are kind of the ways that data is taken now. Okay, so things are being taken, you're concerned about it, you think you want to go possibly file a lawsuit. Before you do, you have to make a couple of decisions and think about the burdens placed on the business and also the burdens placed, the legal burdens associated with actually proving your case. And Justin will talk more about that, but I'll talk briefly about it. But let me first talk about the business burden. Understand litigation is very expensive. It's time-consuming. As it says up there, it's uncertain. So there's concerns about, you know, filing a lawsuit and the costs associated with that. And you got to determine, what do you want to achieve through a lawsuit, right? You want to get injunctive relief. You want to protect your customer base. You want to retrieve your trade secrets. Think about, can you achieve that without actually filing a lawsuit? Is that possible? You know, think about the fact that you're going to have, if you do file a lawsuit, employees are going to have to likely be deposed. They're going to have to provide testimony under oath, either in a deposition or in written form. They may have to show up at a hearing. There's also the potential to have to interfere with customer, vendor, or other business partner relationships. Nobody wants to tell their customers, hey, we're going to need you to testify on our behalf. You don't want to subpoena them for sure and embroil them in this. But there's always that potential. So you need to think about that risk and that burden associated with filing a potential lawsuit. But you should also think about the concept of, what is the burden of not filing a lawsuit? What's the, you know, the failure of litigation? Well, is there a waiver concept? If we don't enforce it against Susie Q, can Joe Smith just go out and do it? If we don't file lawsuits enforcing these, will our competitors get more aggressive and hiring our people and just say, hey, this employer will not enforce their non-compete. Do not worry about it. We've hired 10 of their people before and nothing's happened. So there's that piece. If you do not litigate, what is the marketplace going to think about you as an employer? And then if you do aggressively litigate, you may have the benefit of a deterrent. Other folks may be careful or reticent to leave or go to work for a competitor because of the threat of a lawsuit. And they know that you're not kidding around. You will bring a lawsuit if you need to. right, so the legal burden, right? I think one of the most important things, and Eric touched briefly on this, is the agreement enforceable? There is not one size fits all non-compete. The laws vary dramatically from state to state, from very enforceable with blue penciling to California, where non-competes with employees are unenforceable. And while everybody would like to say, hey, we wouldn't have drafted a restrictive covenant agreement that was unenforceable, the reality is that's not the case. Sometimes employers make decisions, hey, we want to have the best we can one-size-fits-all, understanding that some agreements may not be enforceable in certain states. Or you purchased a company and so you've inherited old agreements. Or you have agreements that were drafted years ago and the law in that particular state has changed. The first thing you need to look at is the agreement enforceable or likely to be enforceable? And then you look at what are the facts? Are we able to prove a violation of this agreement? We want to be able to prove a violation of the agreement, and we're going to be able to have good witnesses that can come forth and help us prove that. You know, obviously, if you have a thumb drive where someone has taken all of, you know, downloaded the family secrets the day before they depart, that's obviously very, very helpful in a lawsuit. If you have no evidence other than they've left and gone to work for a competitor, that's not as helpful in seeking emergency relief, which is what an injunction is in the preliminary or TRO stage. And it also talks about trade secrets up there as well. You're going to be forced by the judge to explain what a trade secret is. You're going to have to be careful about doing that because you're not going to want to do it in open court. You've got to be careful about trying to describe it in such a way or that he understands the concept of trade secret without divulging it in public or have the courtroom sealed or file the stuff under seal. So you also see up there, try to always wear the white hat. You know, in my experience in TROs and injunctive relief, perhaps the most important thing is making sure the judge trusts what you're saying and believes you. Because in those types of situations, it's a gut decision. Do I want to help this person out? Do I need to help this person out? And if you come in there and you make misrepresentations, or if you see the last bullet point, if you breach the agreement first, you know, business folks are not going to want to pay that departing employee their last commissions if they're out competing with them, even though you may be legally required to do that. So you want to make sure you comply with all laws and that you're wearing the white hat when you go into court seeking emergency relief, and that the other side is the one who violated the agreement, took your information, illegally contacted your customers, you know, downloaded stuff the night before they left, those types of activities. Just a few more points here to think about. When you're trying to decide if you're going to file a lawsuit, you've gone through, we've got a breach, we've got the business guys invested in it, they want to move forward the lawsuit, we understand the burden, we feel pretty confident that it's enforceable and that we have the facts to back up a case, you're going to need to give some thought to where do you file your lawsuit? Do you file it in federal court? Do you file it in state court? Does the agreement have an exclusive forum selection clause that would limit your ability to file it? It may say you will file it in New York City, in state or federal court, something like that, and then you have no other option but to file it there. You need to look at what law applies and whether or not there's potential for different laws to apply depending upon where the lawsuit is filed or where the breach occurred. So you need to think about those. You may have to post a bond, so you should be prepared to do that very quickly. Think about if you want to go through the discovery process quickly, you may already have enough through your investigation on the front end. Those are things to think about. You may want to add other claims to it, such as a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim if they've illegally accessed or had unauthorized access to your systems. Think about that, but you also need to weigh, hey, that's a federal claim. If we're filing in state court, they might be able to remove it based on that. So you got to think about if you go in and seek a TRO in state court, is there a way for them to come in and seek a removal and stop your ability to get a very quick TRO by simply removing the case moments before the hearing? And kind of the last thing I'll talk about is that when you run into court, you're going to need to think about these types of things. You know, why are damages inadequate? because to seek a TRO or a preliminary injunction, monetary damages have to be inadequate. You have to have some irreparable harm that can't be quantified, such as customer relationships or the true value of a trade secret, such as the Coca-Cola formula. You can't quantify how much that would be worth. The code for Microsoft, for example. But you're going to need to move very, very quickly, and you're going to need to think about what you're going to need from the judge. What kind of relief are you going to seek? How broad of a non-compete? How broad of a non-solicit? Are you going to seek emergency discovery? Things like that, expedited discovery. And the last point on there I'll talk about is inevitable disclosure. And there are times you can run into court when you don't have an agreement. As I mentioned before, perhaps the CEO is going and they know your strategy and you work at Verizon and they're going to AT&T. Well, even if they didn't have an agreement, although that person likely would, they would inevitably know your strategy, inevitably use that in competing. So you might be able to file a lawsuit even without an agreement. So I ran through this very, very quickly. But there are a lot of facts and things you want to think about in trying to decide whether or not you're going to actually file a lawsuit. But once you've made the decision to file a lawsuit, what's next? And Justin is now going to talk about kind of what you do next to go into court and pursue a lawsuit.
Thanks, Bob. So we are at that point. We have reached the point where an employee is left. We've reached the point where those conversations have taken place internally and you've decided that you are going to move forward with the lawsuit. So the question is first and foremost, what are you filing? The strategy in trade secret and non-compete litigation generally depends on the evidence that you have available. Where there's strong evidence, evidence that an employee has either emailed documents out or downloaded them onto a thumb drive, or you're seeing real substantial evidence of solicitation and movement of customers, those are the types of cases where you want to run into court and move for a temporary restraining order. And before we move on to what some of the other things you're going to look at, realistically, most courts, and this varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but in most courts, in order to prove that a temporary restraining order is necessary, you have to show a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, which effectively means that some percentage, more than 50% likely, that you're going to win the case when you get to trial. You also have to show that you're going to suffer what's called irreparable harm. And irreparable harm is not money. It means you have a customer relationship, and that customer relationship is going to be irretrievably lost. You have a secret, and the value of the information that you have is tied to the fact that it is a secret, and that is going to be disclosed to someone, and you really can't put that genie back in the lamp in that situation. So once you've proven those two elements, the court's going to look at whether or not the injury that you are threatened with outweighs the harm that the injunction may cause. And generally, a loss of employment is not considered to be more substantial than the irreparable harm the company is going to face, but that's a very judge-specific sort of question. And finally, the court is going to weigh whether or not the injunction would adversely affect the public. And there could be a variety of reasons. Maybe it's you have a non-compete that seeks to prohibit a doctor from performing any work, and that is the only doctor that works in the entire county, and the county is going to be put at risk if its doctor is not working. In those circumstances, the court's probably going to say, we're not going to issue a TRO because it's going to do more harm to the public than it will to than to the company. Next, you may have a case where you have some evidence of business loss, but you can't necessarily attribute that to the loss to the employee left. Or you have some suspicion that they've taken, say, hard copy documents, but you have no real evidence that they in fact did so. Under those circumstances, your better tactic may be to move for a preliminary injunction and seek what's called expedited discovery. In those circumstances, what the court is evaluating is after some period of time, during which hopefully they've given you the ability to take further discovery, the court then holds either a mini trial or the evidence that has been collected is then presented to the court. Then in the case where there's a concern of business loss, you're fearful of a business loss, or you're fearful that they've done something with your information. Under those circumstances, you may just want to file a complaint. Before we move into the second steps of the types of lawsuits, I'd like to read now the CLE code. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you early next week. The code is S as in Sam, 9306. Again, that's S as in Sam, 9306. So, factors to consider if you have decided that you have a case where you're going to be filing a motion for temporary restraining order. First, what is your evidence? Is it strong or is it weak? Do we have theft of trade secret, either by email or downloading documents? What you do want to be careful, though, is just because someone has emailed or downloaded documents doesn't mean that they've emailed or downloaded your trade secrets. And so when you're evaluating that question, you really have to be careful that you're conveying to the court the information, conveying to the court accurate information. I had a case several years ago where one of our clients' new employees was sued, and the claim was misappropriation of trade secrets. And they claimed that he had downloaded a substantial amount of documents onto an external hard drive. And once our expert actually analyzed that external hard drive, it determined that the only thing they had downloaded were personal documents, tax records, photos, music files, things that the company had no legitimate business interest in trying to protect, and it was 100% personal to the former employee. Court was not impressed. And I just warn you that when presenting your case, and hopefully you never have a set of attorneys that would attempt to present that as being misappropriation, but it does more harm than good in that particular case. Next question you have to ask, have we lost business? Have we lost customers? If because of the downturn in the economy, if we had asked this question 7-8 years ago, the likelihood is that we would have encountered, most courts would say, you have a non-compete agreement and you've gone to a competitor, they're going to issue a temporary restraining order. But since when the economy tanked, a lot of courts have changed their opinion on that. And so even in situations where you have a non-compete and they've absolutely gone to a direct competitor, but there's no evidence of lost business and there's no evidence of misappropriation, courts are much more reluctant to issue temporary restraining orders. And finally, a really important question, and maybe in fact the most important question, is the business on board? Because at the end of the day, the reality is you're going to have to convince the business that it should dedicate time, energy, and potentially money, depending on how your litigation budget is accounted for internally, to actually fund the litigation. You've decided in you're filing a motion for temporary restraining order. You have to be prepared. The litigation is generally fast and furious. It's also generally quite expensive. At the outset in a temporary restraining order case, you're typically filing a complaint, a motion for temporary restraining order that also includes substantial briefing that's outlining facts and law, usually filing a motion for expedited discovery, which also attaches the draft discovery. You're preparing a draft order for temporary restraining order that you're setting forth to the court. This is a relief we want. You're generally drafting an order granting expedited discovery, which is setting out how you want the discovery calendar to unfold. And then in addition to that, you're generally interviewing several people within the company to actually put forth your story. Because a motion for temporary restraining order is a document that requires evidence to be presented to the court. It's usually not testimony. It's usually in the form of an affidavit or a declaration. But the court is going to want to see some evidence or some facts to back up what you're seeking. You then also need to consider, how are we going to get the defendants served? Can we serve them electronically? Is there some provision in your agreement allowing you to do that? Do we have an email address where we can send it to them? Do we have process servers lined up? Do we have process servers we trust who are going to serve them right away? You're going to have to coordinate with the court to actually get a temporary restraining order date. And you have to remember that in litigation, in this new era, you also have to be reminding your internal employees that they can't destroy any evidence, or that could be weighed heavily against you later on. Litigation, even non-compete litigation, can last several years. So if you have auto-deletion policies that kick in after 30, 60, 90 days, you want to make sure that the group who's going to have relevant information or potentially relevant information, that those emails aren't being deleted. If the motion for temporary restraining order is granted, you have to remember it's really not the end of the process. You may need to issue or secure an injunction bond, which is going to protect the defendant if the court later decides the injunction was improperly granted. You also have to remember that the TRO, it's not usually an indefinite amount of time. My slide might be a little dated. It's actually 14 actual days now, and it used to be 10 business days, but 14 days under the federal rules is the time by which a temporary restraining order can be issued unless there's a reason the court thinks is necessary or the parties stipulate to it. So in many instances, you may win on the TRO, and then you may actually enter into a stipulation with the other side to say, we're going to have the temporary restraining order last until the preliminary injunction hearing takes place. If the court grants the temporary restraining order, very often it's going to say, I want to see you back here in X amount of days, and we're going to have a preliminary injunction hearing. And if that's the case, then you're really going to have to move quickly with your both written and oral discovery, and that can be, you know, very time-consuming, both for taking the depositions, but also for preparing your witnesses in-house. And even if you win, if there's a preliminary injunction hearing, you're probably going to file additional briefs as well as actually partake in the actual preliminary injunction, which is really like a mini trial. It usually unfolds exactly like a trial, except you may not be seeking actual damages at that point. Well, what happens if the motion is denied? Well, the reality is probably very little changes outside of the fact that you're not going to have the same protection that you would if a TRO was granted. You're still going to want to seek the expedited discovery. You're still going to want to have the preliminary injunction hearing. You're still going to want to move as rapidly as possible. I will say that psychologically, many companies that we work with, when they actually win the temporary restraining order, their general reaction is to almost take their foot off the brake, try to slow things down, particularly if they have that stipulated injunction. If you lose the TRO, you have to remember that's not to your benefit, because you're still operating without the protection and the employee is theoretically still out there seeking to take your business. And another consideration, a lot of states and the federal government also have expedited appellate processes for challenging whether or not a TRO was either improperly granted or improperly denied. So that may be another consideration if you think the judge really just got it wrong. So if you decide that your evidence isn't enough to actually go forward with a motion for TRO, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't bring your case. It just may mean that the procedural process by which you do bring it is a little different. You still would be preparing your complaint. You may just move from an expedited discovery. You may seek a motion for preliminary injunction at the same time that you have a motion for expedited discovery. Again, you're not going to have the court's protection during the time that you're doing the discovery. But again, frequently when you put another business on notice that you think there's a violation, most businesses don't want to unfairly compete. So the reality is oftentimes the parties will figure out a way to either put the employee on the sideline when you do the discovery, or put in some other manners in which to assure that the party bringing the lawsuit feels protected in the interim. In some ways, this lawsuit could be viewed as being a bit of a placeholder. You're not seeking the temporary injunctive relief, but you're telling the court, we anticipate we're going to do this, and we want to have you consider this in a quick basis. So again, the court understands that there's that even if you don't articulate it this way, the court is going to understand that there is at a minimum some significant threat that is going to bring you in front of the court, but perhaps you need a little bit more to get there. What we cover this a bit in the even in the last slide, but in the motion for expedited discovery process, you're going to want to be careful in the way that you craft that motion, because the reality is that discovery is expensive for anyone, and the court may say, I don't know that there's enough here. I don't know that your non-compete is enforceable. I don't know that the trade the allegations of misappropriation are correct. Let's slow this down. So in this particular case, and sort of to work off of something that Eric and Bob both said, you really need to articulate why your trade secrets are at risk, or why your employment or why your customer relationships are at risk, or if they're raiding your company, why your employee workforce is at risk. It's you're going to have some of the same burden that you have in a motion for TRO, but without having to go to quite the same lengths to prove your case at that point. In any litigation, and truly in TRO litigation as well, you really do need to be mindful of what defenses the other side may bring. And this is important for the strategic piece of it when you're considering bringing the lawsuit, but also for where you file the lawsuit, how you file the lawsuit, et cetera. Typical defenses that we see in trade secret and non-compete cases include whether or not there was sufficient consideration to support the non-compete. There's a trend in the United States currently where several states are saying that continued employment isn't sufficient to bind an employee to a non-compete agreement. That's a changing element of the law, and if you are working off of older non-competes, it may be fatal to your case. I know Bob mentioned it, the idea of the unclean hands. That could be anywhere from you discriminated against the employee to you didn't pay them to that you promised them a promotion for signing the non-compete and you didn't give it to them. So there are a variety of reasons why that may be an issue. There may be choice of law and venue issues where, you know, for example, you're bringing a lawsuit against a California employee who has a Illinois choice of law. There may be issues there. You may just be wrong, and you may think that they breached, but they really didn't. And that's something you need to weigh in deciding how you're going to pursue the case. And then there's also the factor of there's an innocent explanation for downloaded documents. Most of these litigation tends to settle. I would say probably at least 8 out of 10 of these cases settle within the first 6 months. And so when evaluating your case, an important consideration is, what is the actual goal of the litigation? Are you trying to stop competition or stop the bleeding? Are you trying to get money back? Are you trying to get the court to enter a stipulated permanent injunction? Are you looking to get property back? Are you looking for a quickly negotiated resolution? All of these things are important to consider even at the outset of the litigation, because if your business understands where they want to be, then it's easier for your attorneys to get you to that place. And you also need to recognize that if the goal is to resolve the case early or to get some assurances that the former employee is not competing unfairly or didn't misappropriate information, be mindful that any attorney who has done this more than once understands and is hopefully telling their clients that the litigation can be expensive. So there is opportunities to settle this quickly. But it's also important to note, when you're talking about significant business that's at risk, or you're talking about someone who walked out the door with very important trade secrets, business plans, 5-year projections, things like that, the litigation may be the only way that you're able to actually protect those relationships and that information. So we are at the end of our time and not seeing any questions. If any of you want to email us, our email addresses are at the end of the slides here, and we are happy to answer any questions. But at a very minimum, please consider following us. We blog on these types of topics very frequently. We are one of the premier blogs on trade secrets, non-competes, and computer fraud issues, and we've enjoyed having you participate in our webinar this afternoon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.